Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's announcement of plans to tax millionaires and his threat to veto any Republican deficit reduction package that does not include raising revenues. One of the country's leading experts on tax policy, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston, joins us. Then we will look into Republican plans to restrict Democratic voters' access to the polls in key states in next year's election. Daniel Tokarji, professor of law at Ohio State University, joins us to discuss what Ohio's governor and legislature are implementing in terms of restrictions and impediments to either discourage Democratic turnout or to make it more difficult for the poor and elderly to vote. Then we'll look into plans in Pennsylvania by the Republican governor and legislature to change the state's electoral college votes to favor the Republican presidential candidate. Pennsylvania pollster Dr. G. Terry Madonna, who directs the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, joins us to explain where this proposed change stands and how it is playing out in Pennsylvania politics. And I would like to invite you to the Hammer Forum I'm conducting this Wednesday, September the 21st at 7 p.m., America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda, co-presented by Penn USA, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent Eric Schmidt, and national security expert John Mueller join us to discuss whether we are winning the war on terror. Eric Schmidt covers terrorism and national security issues for the New York Times and is the co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. And questioning the costs and strategy is John Mueller, the author of Terrorism, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Again, this coming Wednesday, September the 21st at 7 p.m., it's free to the public, the Hammer Forum in Westwood. I hope you can join me. Joining us now is David K. Johnston, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with the New York Times. He teaches at Syracuse University's College of Law. He writes a column for Reuters and has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. He's the author of the best-selling books Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
The President made a speech today outlining his plans to tax millionaires and threatening a veto if the Republicans don't come along with. He's referring, of course, to Warren Buffett, and Warren Buffett's secretary shouldn't pay higher tax rates than Warren Buffett. Do you think this populist message that the president is delivering is going to work?
Well, I don't know, but the president has laid a very, very clever trap for the Republicans, because included in his bill is a tax cut for employers and all workers, everybody who has a job, in 2012, and a big bonus for business, allowing them to expense all their capital expenditures that year. So if the Republicans kill this because they don't like what happens the next year when taxes would go up on the very highest income earners by 1.2% of their income on average, they will be on record voting against tax cuts for all Americans with a job and for all businesses. That's where the politics of this are going to get really interesting.
So, I take it the president's also trying to gain popular support here and anticipate the Republican response. He's arguing, of course, this is not class warfare, it's math. But in terms of the math, David K. Johnston, how does it pan out? Because, you know, we had tax cuts in the original stimulus package that many argued diluted its effect. And, of course, we've run out, and a lot of people said it wasn't enough. Clearly, the economy indicates that it wasn't. In terms of revenues to tax cuts, what's the math there?
Well, the math is that Obama, when he came into office, had a plan to dramatically reduce deficits and do so over a period of years. He has now acquiesced to all sorts of Republican demands so that if his plans are adopted, the Congressional Budget Office, and this is before this tax increase proposal, shows that by the end of this decade, deficits will be down to an insignificant issue. But the Republicans, by insisting that we retain the tax cuts, that temporary tax cut sponsored by President Bush for the very highest income Americans, the 1 in 600 Americans who make over $1 million a year, then that complicates this. The president says his jobs plan, his American Jobs Act, is entirely paid for. There will be lots of arguments about that. There is no argument, however, that the stimulus plan that he originally put forward was less than half the size that was needed, and that 40% of it was wasted on business tax cuts, which are inherently anti-stimulus. They are, in fact, encouraging a form of savings. And we're in a situation where, as people save, there's the paradox of thrift. It makes the economy worse. It needs to be worse for a while, perhaps, but this heightens the problem. So the short and long of this is that Obama's plan would encourage employers to hire. It would provide a huge tax break in 2012 to businesses that have capital investments. It would raise taxes on earners at the top who have been enjoying these incredibly low tax rates that I've been writing about for years, but barely. I mean, a 1.2% increase. People make over $1 million would pay on average $39,000 a year more. Their average income is $3 million. This is an insignificant amount of money to somebody making $3 million, which is, by the way, more than twice what the median income taxpayer will earn in their lifetime.
So then this is not changing the rules in any significant way. This is not redressing the income disparity. This is not gouging the rich. This is
smart politics. This is a president who I've been highly critical of since 10 days after he came into office of what he has done, but who has come up with a plan here that paints the Republicans into their own corner, that forces them to choose whether they're going to vote against a tax cut for business and for every person. I mean, think about the election in the fall of next year and what the campaign ads will look like if this gets to a vote or they block a vote, and then it will be they're afraid to let it come up for a vote. And it will have a minimal effect on the economy. So long as we have the current Republican leaders in control of the House, the radicals and the reactionaries, rather than, you know, practical people, nothing will change. We will have gridlock. The president will not get anything through, and the country will drift. And drifting usually means, you know, you're put in danger that you're going to hit shoals and sink.
Well, but we've seen David K. Johnston, again, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who writes a column on taxes for Reuters, and we're talking about the president's speech today and the challenge to the Republicans to raise the taxes on the rich and threatens to veto any rejection of this package by the Republicans. So we had the hostage crisis, the debt ceiling hostage crisis. That was incredibly reckless. There's a general impression that the Republicans have an investment in a bad economy because that will help them, their personal political ambitions over the welfare of the country. That's already going on, and they seem to get away with it. So,
well, and yes, the, and they most haven't of the forced yet mean to vote against a tax cut for everybody for 1 year and against a huge tax benefit for businesses that make capital investments. That's where the whatever else people think of Obama as a leader, boy, when it comes to tactics in politics, he's really good.
And so if you combine this with the fact that apparently the Republicans, when they go back to their districts, are getting an earful, which is what the president in his speech to the Congress basically was suggesting, that I'm going to go to your districts and campaign. So you're saying, combined with that, with the president going on the road and campaigning in their districts, and the cleverness of the way this is packaged, do you think that the Republicans are going to actually vote for it? I mean,
no, I don't think. I cannot imagine Eric Cantor, who's a radical and totally supports whatever the hedge fund managers and others want so that they can avoid taxes today and make you pick up the burden, the that they should be sharing is going to go along with this. We have a whole group of Tea Party people who will say, you can hear right now what they're going to say, well, yes, I voted against this tax increase, but it was this tax cut, but it was because there would be increases in subsequent years, and this is deceitful and trickery by President Obama. But I don't think that's going to sell with the American public. I mean, with 30 million people unemployed or underemployed, with all sorts of people losing their homes, with people losing their health insurance, I don't think that most American voters are going around thinking, you know, Eric Cantor is right, and the rich just can't bear a heavier burden, and I need to suffer and lose my home and lose my health insurance and watch my spouse die because they don't have medical coverage because the rich just don't have enough.
Well, David K. Johnson, it seems though the Republicans have successfully shifted the debate for the last year or so onto how important deficit reduction is as opposed to stimulating the economy. And that flies in the face of all most economic reality. And we do have this peculiar disconnect between economic realities and political possibilities. I think most economists think that cutting $1 trillion out of a sick economy makes absolutely no sense. There's no, he's got an uphill battle against the mantra that they've got out there, which is, well, you know, we tried the stimulus and look where it got us. You know, no mention of George W. Bush's $5 trillion hole that he dug.
I think, Ian, that is about to change. I agree with you. The Republicans have been very successful in for years pursuing borrow and spend, which is what created these huge budget deficits. They have confused the American public. There seem to be a lot of people who think that Obama is doubling the federal deficit. In fact, President Obama's first budget had a smaller deficit than George Bush's last budget, and he would have much smaller deficits today, except for the Republicans basically forcing large deficits. And yes, it's difficult to sell this. It's difficult when you have people like Charles Krauthammer, the psychiatrist who writes a column for the Washington Post, saying Social Security is a Ponzi scheme when it's in fact the opposite of a Ponzi scheme. And what you have, and this is what my Tuesday column last week in Reuters was called, nonsense posing as wisdom. You have people who do not understand public finance or who assume the public doesn't get it, simply saying ridiculously untrue things. And I show this in the column item by item. Curiously, I got to tell you, there are people who posted there saying, well, obviously this guy's never taken a course in economics in his life, which tells you that they are part of this group in America who are motivated by ideology, not by reality. But they're a minority. All the surveys show overwhelming public support for government intervention to improve the economy and for higher taxes on the very best off Americans. It doesn't matter who does the poll. It doesn't matter how they ask the question. In fact, the only differences in the poll results stem from the way the questions are framed, and then they're relatively minor differences.
So where does this, where does the traction come from for this almost reflexive argument that comes out whenever you talk about the redistribution of wealth and fairness in this country? Immediately there's this cacophony of cries about class warfare.
Well, that's easy to explain. As Warren Buffett has said, there is class warfare going on in America, and my side is winning. You have a group of oligarchs who are fabulously wealthy, who spend a minute portion of their money promoting what they believe. And by the way, understand, these people believe what they're doing. It's important to recognize they are honest about it in their own minds. They believe they're doing the right thing. The Koch brothers don't sit there going, oh, I want to do evil things. It's like, we think America would be a better place if the policies we're pushing for were put in place. Well, so they pour money into Cato and Heritage and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and all these other ideological marketing organizations, which the mainstream media treats not as if they're the political equivalent of Madison Avenue, but as if they're serious research organizations, which they're not. And, of course, you have faux news on television from Rupert Murdoch, where there's so much evidence of they're just making things up, distorting things, clipping quotes to make black appear to be white. that I don't think anybody needs to treat them anymore as a serious organization, but they are a powerful organization, and there are polls showing people who regularly watch that stuff believe that's the truth, because they're in this echo chamber that tells them what they want to hear. That's not most Americans. And this particular plan, while it's not going to become law, has really put the Republicans in a corner, because they're going to have to either not vote for a big tax cut, or they're going to have to go on record that they're afraid to vote for it. That's got to hurt. That's got to hurt.
Well, this is definitely a turnaround, if you're correct, David K. Johnston. And, of course, you know, cynics and skeptics and critics of Obama would say, well, you know, he's a bit late in the day. But then, on the other hand, you know, people don't pay attention to elections, certainly 14 months ahead of them, except the punditry. There may be some, this may be a turnaround. My concern is that you know, history as a guide, with the unemployment numbers that the president running like a millstone around his neck, traditionally, you know, the president can't carry that weight and is voted out. That's just the record, and there's a sense out there of anger and confusion which is being exploited in many ways. Anger and confusion, distraction are stronger emotions than a kind of reasoned disappointment. And as many of people on the right that hate Obama, there's an equal, you know, growing number on the left that are disappointed with him. So, that's no news, I guess, that he's got his work cut out.
Yes, there's no question, Ian, that, you know, this is not a simple issue. But fundamentally, I think it's very clear that the Republicans' mantra, which is you cannot raise taxes on the rich because they won't create jobs, has been shown to be nonsense. McClatchy newspapers went out and asked businessmen all over the place, you know, would you hire more workers if your taxes were cut? And they basically got answers that said, what kind of a crazy question is that? The guy who just bought the house next door to me, a manufacturer with 150 employees, I walked over to introduce myself to him, and I said, you know, by the way, would you, and he looked at me like that was the craziest question in the world. I am part owner of a business with 25 employees at the peak each year. I can't imagine hiring somebody for a tax cut. You hire people when you have demand. Well, that means you have to have people have jobs. That means you have to have people who are earning enough money to buy products and services. And everybody in America seems to get that, except the oligarchs who don't believe that, and the Republican radicals in Congress who they support.
Well, you know, I get accused of using the word oligarch too much, and it seems to me that it's used too little, and because it really is the defining issue, whether we are still a democracy, because you cannot be both an oligarchy and a democracy. So I just in closing, David K. Johnston, you think that there's a chance that the landscape can be turned around, and that without this cacophony of calls of class warfare dampening anybody's determination.
Well, I think that you will see a big upsurge in claims of class warfare and attacks like that. You know, robust debate is what democracy is about. We need to have robust debate. If we get people to recognize that sitting there and watching Dancing with the Stars and paying no attention to politics is not good for their personal economics, things will begin to change. But, you know, we live in a democracy. People don't vote. Well, the people who do vote have more power. People don't listen and learn. Then they get swayed by people who tell them things that are deceitful or just flat-out nonsense.
But what about promising them a job?
What
about promising them a job, which is what Perry's doing? I mean, you know, he's saying, I'm the guy that created jobs. Romney's going to try the same tactic as well.
Well, if Romney is the nominee, you can see what the ads there will be. It'll be all the companies acquired by Bain Capital when he was there and all the people they fired. And you'll see people saying, I had a career, I had a household, I lost everything. And at the end, you'll see, you know, Mitt Romney and whatever his fortune is, $190 million, $300 million, job destroyer. If it's Rick Perry, this is the guy who's been in the public payroll his whole life and who has lots of liabilities of his own. Now, that doesn't mean that they might not get elected. Either one of them might get elected. Romney would probably turn out to be an okay president. I mean, he is fundamentally a rational, realistic human being. He just comes from a particular perspective. Perry would be a disaster for the country, and his track record shows that. The jobs they've been creating in Texas are, you know, jobs without health insurance. He's been cutting spending on education steadily. If it weren't for money that his brother, I mean, brother Republican, his successor, sent there in the early 2000s, his income would have fallen. I'm sorry, his spending on education would have fallen. And this is a guy who got a bill passed to fund public education, partly with a tax on topless bar customers. I'm sorry, this is not a serious person.
Well, that's putting it mildly. I thank you for joining us here today, David K. Johnson.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with the New York Times. He teaches at Syracuse University's College of Law. He writes a column for Reuters on tax issues. He's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States because he's uncovered so many tax dodges. He's the author of the best-selling books, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Republican plans to rig the next election.
But the music that excels is the sound of oil wells as they slurp, slurp, slurp into the barrels. My little home will be quaint as an old parasol, and instead of carpets I'll have money wall to wall. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire.
Well, it's all right, even when push comes to shove.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Kataji, who is a professor of law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and senior fellow of election law at Moritz. He recently was visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School. His area of expertise includes election law, civil rights, and federal courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Kataji.
Thank you so much for having me.
And clearly there are plans afoot to change the rules in many of the states that in the last 2010 elections that the Republicans won the trifectas, both houses in the state houses and the governorships. In your state of Ohio, there are already moves afoot, are there not? And there's been some controversy over these in terms of changing the absentee ballot rules. So walk us through, because in broad strokes what's going on here is that these legislatures, Republicans in these legislatures, are trimming early voting days. They're making intensifying voter identification requirements, putting restrictions on absentee ballots. What's happening in Ohio?
Well, so this is part of a nationwide movement on the part of Republicans controlling state legislatures, in my view, to make it more difficult for people to vote and have their votes counted. Ohio is one of the states where we formerly had a Democratic governor as well as Democrats in control of one of our two chambers of the state legislature. Now the Republicans control everything, and they have recently adopted an election bill that, bottom line, makes it more difficult for people to vote early and absentee. And, of course, in the last presidential election, 2008, early voting in particular was heavily used by Democratic-leaning voters, especially by voters in the African-American community. Now, early voting has been eliminated on the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday right before the, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday right before the election, which are the three most heavily used days. And we're seeing similar things in other swing states, including Florida, where they've made voter registration more difficult, as well as curbing early voting. Wisconsin, which has adopted a bill requiring government-issued photo ID. In states where Republicans now control the legislature, they're taking strong steps to make it more difficult to vote.
And in terms of the voter ID restrictions, Kansas, Wisconsin, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas have recently passed strict voter ID laws. And prior to that, of course, Georgia and Indiana required the voters to show an ID in order to have their votes counted.
That's exactly right. And these are all states where Republicans now control the legislature, and they've enacted laws which require government-issued photo identification in order to vote. Roughly 11% of voters don't have that, and a disproportionate number of those people who don't have the required ID are poor people and people of color. So it's something that's going to have an especially harsh impact on Democratic-leaning groups of voters.
But it's sensibly being sold on the basis of fraud. Now, there's very few cases ever been brought, I believe, in terms of voter fraud. And in the states where they're imposing these restrictions, I don't imagine that situation is any different. So,
yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, there's only one very narrow kind of fraud that this law would actually prevent, and that is in-person voter impersonation fraud, someone going to the polling place pretending to be someone they are not. And in the rare instances where we actually do have voter fraud in this country, almost always done with absentee ballots, which stands to reason because you're less likely to get caught that way than you are actually going to the polls pretending to be someone you are not. So the problem that they're ostensibly trying to address is, for all practical purposes, non-existent. The only effect these laws are likely to have is to make it more difficult for certain groups, poor people, minorities, as well as elderly voters and college students to vote.
And what is the impediment there? Because, and again, they make it sound like it's reasonable, but it's actually quite mendacious and deliberately so. So what prevents poor people and students from getting this government-issued ID? So you're talking about state, because the states control elections. So it's
right. Now, I think for these laws to be upheld, they're going to have to provide the ID free of charge, as at least most of them do. But the problem is people still need money to get the underlying documents, like a birth certificate, especially if you're talking about a homeless person or someone who was born in another state that they have to send away, may cost them money. And that's effectively, in my view, a poll tax, because you're having to spend money as well as time in order to get the documents you need in order to vote and have your votes counted. Now, those kinds of burdens on the vote might be justified if there were, in fact, a real problem to be solved, but the evidence shows that they're not, that the problem that they're purportedly attempting to address, in-person voter impersonation fraud, is practically non-existent.
So, again, I'm speaking with Daniel Takagi, who is a professor of law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and a senior fellow at election law at Moritz. He was recently a visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School. We're talking about across the country, newly elected Republican legislatures from the 2010 elections are changing elections laws in advance of the 2012 elections. And so we have 32 states and the District of Columbia where you can cast a ballot in person before election day, in other words, absentee ballots. There's a whole number of states now that are rolling back the voting time prior to the vote, the window at which you can place your absentee ballots. Florida, of course, just rolled back its early voting time from 1 week to 2. And of course that makes it difficult for groups like the League of Women Voters and the Boy Scouts of America and others to conduct their voter registration drives. So,
and they've also increased penalties, imposing them on groups that don't turn in forms within 48 hours, which has caused the League of Women Voters to stop its voter registration activities in the state because of the possibility of potentially debilitating fines. People just, you know, make a mistake and don't turn them in within 48 hours.
So again, it's made to seem like it's a reasonable thing to do. Or what is that rationale? Because why do you have to restrict it from 2 weeks to one? What arguments did they proffer?
Well, the arguments that they make first and foremost are reducing the cost. And I suppose the question is, what do we think the right to vote is worth? Do we think it is worth spending a relatively small amount of money, certainly when we look to other things like health care and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that our government has been spending money on? The amount that we spend for voting and our voting equipment and election administration in this country is minuscule when you compare it to those amounts. So, you know, my view is, even if it costs a slight bit more money, it's worth spending, and moreover, it's important to take the pressure off the polls on election day. In my state and a number of other states, we've seen, especially in presidential elections, long lines at the polls. Well, if we allow people to vote early, that will help take the pressure off the polling place on election day. And in fact, we did not see the kinds of huge lines in the last election, despite the fact that we had huge turnout, in part because we had voters making extensive use of early and absentee voting before election day.
So, Daniel Takashi, do you think that one of the reasons that people get away with this is that in the United States there isn't a kind of global knowledge of where the United States stands? I mean, after the 2000 fiasco in Florida, I think there was a kind of a wake-up call in terms of a lot of people suggesting that Florida was a kind of banana republic and this was very third world. Well, ironically, in a lot of countries in the third world, the voting systems are better run. I mean, next door in Mexico, for example, they're better run. Everybody has a voter ID card. There's no impediments in most countries, like registration itself.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. I was going to go to registration because, you know, you look at Canada, our neighbor to the north. Americans just tend to assume that our democracy is superior, but in many respects, it is not. Most notably, voter registration, where other states, other countries, rather, take affirmative steps to make sure that every eligible citizen is registered. So, Canada's registration rate far exceeds that of the United States, and as you would expect, their turnout rate does as well. And you know, other states have nonpartisan election administration. In the United States, it's really quite astounding that people with a direct state stake in the outcome, that is, elected officials who are elected as representatives of their party, are actually running elections at the state level in the United States. People from other countries often think that this is extraordinary. It's an inherent and obvious conflict of interest.
So is there any possibility of educating the people, or does it go back to the days of the founding fathers, where the first concession that the federal government had to make to get the 13 colonies to join was that the states control elections? Because it is obviously a patchwork.
Yeah. I mean, it is what you might call an accident of history, the fact that we have this incredibly decentralized and partisan system of running elections in this country. What can you do about it? I mean, I do think it is something where you can actually make some improvements by educating the public. In fact, we have had some areas in the last 10 years where we've seen improvements because of the Florida election and Bush versus Gore. I think our voting registration systems are better than they were 10 years ago. We lose fewer votes because we've gotten rid of punch cards. But, you know, it's a long, slow process. And what I will say on the more optimistic side is that voting rights are something which tends to galvanize people, especially progressives. And I wish that we'd seen more attention to this flurry of state laws that you described at the outset. You know, in addition to changing the rules according to which elections are run, we're now seeing moves in some states to gerrymander district lines, which are going to affect who gets elected to office for the next decade. And Pennsylvania, at least, is talking about changing its system for allocating electoral votes in a way that is likely to favor Republicans. And
yeah, we're going to be covering that in the next segment, yeah. As a matter of fact.
Yeah, I do think that this is something where it is possible to mobilize people, although sadly we haven't seen enough of that in the last 9 months or so, during which Republican state legislatures have been passing restrictive voting laws left and right.
So, in other words, a state where you basically it's 50-50. If you 12 out of 16, it makes it what 75? Yeah, 75-30, 25.
Yeah. I mean, it's you got to give them credit. It's a devious gerrymander, and it's they could not possibly have drawn the lines in a way that better serve the interests of the Republican Party.
Well, but Governor Kasich is obviously, I mean, he's a Fox News commentator, a very partisan Republican activist, isn't he?
That's right, but I'm not sure how much exactly he's been directly involved in the process, but the Republican Party is clearly calling the shots here and has created a map. By the way, they dropped it on Tuesday of last week, and the House committee voted it out the next day in an effort to have as little meaningful public comment on it as possible. I mean, it was about as atrocious a process as you could imagine, and we can see why now that we've had some time to review the map. I mean, it is an egregious gerrymander.
Mm-hmm. And then, and because of they're compressing all the Democrats four out of the 16.
Yeah.
You've got Marcy Kaptur running against Kucinich. Is that?
That's right. Yeah.
Well, of course, a lot of our listeners will remember Daniel Takagi, how 2004 ended. Right. That it was Kedu in Ohio, wasn't it?
Yeah. And there were a ton of voting problems here. Of course, at the time, our Secretary of State was a Republican, Ken Blackwell, who made a number of questionable and highly contested decisions, such as decisions having to do with provisional ballots, whether they'd be counted, as well as the most controversial decision was probably one where he required that registration forms be on at least 80-pound paperweight in order to be accepted. Under pressure, he ultimately rescinded that directive. But there were a lot of shenanigans, at least surrounding Ohio's election. You know, I think the margin was large enough, over 100,000 votes, that it was pretty clear that, in my opinion at least, that George W. Bush won Ohio, notwithstanding these problems. But it did not give the public much confidence that the result here in Ohio was on the up and up.
And the new Secretary of State, John Husted, he's a Republican too, right?
He is, and I have to give Secretary of State Husted some credit for opposing the photo ID bill that the Republicans in the state legislature proposed. I think that really turned the tide, and his opposition is a big part of the reason why the Ohio legislature has not, at least not yet, enacted a very restrictive government-issued photo ID bill. I mean, he's certainly, Secretary State Husted has advocated some things that I don't agree with, but I think when Republicans actually do the right thing and stand up to their own party in opposition to these vote suppression bills, we ought to give them some credit.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Daniel Takagi.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Takagi, who's a professor of law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and a senior fellow at the election law at Moritz. He recently was a visiting professor of law at Harvard Law School. His area of expertise includes election law, civil rights, and federal courts. We're going to be taking a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the state of Pennsylvania's Republican legislature and governor plan to change the electoral college rules in that state. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. G. Terry Madonna, who's Professor of Public Affairs and Director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. He has written extensively about voters and voting behavior and founded the Keystone Poll in 1992, the oldest survey produced exclusively in Pennsylvania, which has been renamed the Franklin and Marshall College Poll. He is also the pollster for the Philadelphia Daily News and many other newspapers and television stations in Pennsylvania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Terry Madonna.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And clearly the state of Pennsylvania is poised to make a fairly radical change, is it not, in the Electoral College rules. Instead of a winner-take-all, it would essentially reapportion the votes according to congressional districts. And the congressional districts are such that instead of, in the last election, President Obama got 21 electoral votes in the winner-take-all situation in Pennsylvania. In 2012, the district redistricting has taken the votes, the total down to 20. But if Obama were to win the popular vote, and he would normally get the 20 votes. Under the new rules, the Republicans are likely to get 12 of those votes and Obama only 8. And in a close election, that could be the deciding factor.
Yeah, that's certainly accurate. And, you know, I went back and looked the change of the electoral vote on the Republican side in favor of giving the Republicans, as you point out, 12, maybe 11 or 10, whatever the number might be, would not have changed any presidential election, you know, since before the Civil War. And I didn't go back and look earlier than that. But in my judgment, most of us in the state are having trouble understanding the motivation behind this. Even Republicans have come out strongly against this plan, which is being put forward by a suburban Philadelphia Republican who is the majority leader in a Senate that's controlled by Republicans, as is the House in our state, as is the governorship. But the governor is for it, and some Republican leaders in the House. So you're accurate in the sense that if they push hard with this change, Ian, they have the votes to bring it about. But there is all sorts of pushback now coming from national and state Republican Party leaders, as well as Republican members of Congress in the swing districts, which right now are in Republican hands in Pennsylvania, which could be severely affected by this change.
And why would that be affected by the change?
Well, no any longer. If you go to a congressional district system, you know, in which one elector for each election district, in Pennsylvania about two-thirds of them are already decided because, you know, they're strongly Republican or strongly Democrat. The marginal congressional districts, the competitive ones, every single one is in Republican hands. Translation, now instead of putting the money in the big cities to increase Democratic turnout, President Obama, for example, and this is what Republicans fear, would dump all sorts of money and his political allies in these competitive congressional districts, of which there are, as I point out, 5 or 6, and they now, the Republican members of Congress who are the incumbents, would face all of these new challenges within their districts. You know, all this money coming in from presidential campaigns, from third parties, from, by that I mean the interest groups, the 501Cs, you know, you name it. And the Republican members of Congress are very concerned that that could change the political calculation in those districts, which right now is competitive, but it could help the Democrats, and that's why they're deeply concerned about it.
But, you know, if you're a partisan Republican and somebody working at the national level, either for candidate Perry or for,
sure,
for candidate whoever, you know, Romney or whoever is the nominee, the idea that instead of Obama winning 20 in a winner-take-all,
right,
in Pennsylvania, if he only ends up with 8,
sure,
that's
oh, yeah,
money in the bank.
I don't disagree with that, with you on that. If you're the candidate's campaign manager, for example, you'd say that's not a bad idea. However, the Republican national chairman has been coy, originally came out against it. He then gave a speech, by the way, at a meeting in Pennsylvania before the Republican State Committee over the weekend, and he urged to go slow. I think it depends where you fall in terms of how it might affect you. You know, if you're a candidate, you know, as you point out, if you're Rick Perry or you're Mitt Romney, whoever the nominee might be, you might think this is a good idea. If you're a member of Congress or if you're a party leader and you're looking at the broader picture, you might have second thoughts about it. I was actually surprised. I wrote a piece about this, a colleague and I, that as soon as it came out, and I was actually stunned because I'm not convinced that they thought this all the way through. And it came out of the blue. I mean, there was no buildup. Normally you get a buildup, you have press conferences, you have people going around and talking about it. But this literally came out of the night. Not like what you had in your state where you had this big debate on the National Popular Vote Compact, which you all have approved out in California. You know, it had a lot of buildup, a lot of debate over it. There's been no debate on this in my state. Now, the governor and the Senate Majority Leader have said there'll be hearings, and now there'll be debate, I think, in large part because of the pushback by not just Democrats who are apoplectic over it, as you might expect, but by the some Republicans as well.
Well, the governor, though, Tom Corbett, has said he will support this bill.
Yes, he will support it, but he wants hearings, and he has urged Republicans, and he gave a talk at this big Republican powwow that I referenced a moment ago, and he said, I don't want this to get in the way of the fall elections in our state. Like, you know, California, we have municipal elections and court elections in these odd-numbered years. But he cautioned people not to let the debate over this, you know, divide Republicans and to keep focused on the off-year election. My comment was, well, then why did you bring it up on the eve of these elections and start this big debate if you don't want people, you know, to be engaged in it, which they, in my state, they, and this, as you point out, has become a national story as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. G. Terry Madonna, who's professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College, leading pollster in the state of Pennsylvania, and we're talking about plans on the part of the Republican legislature to change the Electoral College rules to be in line with only two other states in the union, which are Nebraska and Maine, that award their electoral college votes to by congressional district. And this is a change from a winner-take-all system, which would disadvantage a Democratic president who would normally has normally, at least since, 1988.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean,
Democrats have won, and that means that they've won all of the electoral votes.
That's
now
right.
they would win less than half under the new system. And meanwhile, the former Democratic governor Ed Rendell has referred to this proposal. The motivation for this is somewhere between despicable and reprehensible.
Well, no one ever said that former Governor Rendell wouldn't lay it on the line. He's pretty blunt. You know, the other thing about the CN that sort of surprises me, as you pointed out, we've got two states that have done this in the, you know, since the 20th century. Michigan did it in the late 19th century, and earlier in the Republic, you know, after the Constitution was adopted, a number of states did pick electors on at the congressional district level in the method that you've been describing. I went back and looked at the turnout. You know, I thought, well, maybe this will, the Republicans think they'll increase their turnout and somehow this will help them. I went and looked at Maine, one of the two other states, and historically over the last couple of decades, regardless of whether it's a presidential election or a midterm election, Maine has had among the highest turnout rates in the country. Then I looked at Nebraska. In 2008, Nebraska was 30th in overall turnout. And Nebraska, as many, perhaps all of your listeners do not know, has three congressional districts. They, you know, selected their electors out of those districts, three of them. Their turnout was 30%. Pennsylvania's was 26%. So another thing that the argument for it was, well, this will increase interest in, you know, represent the diversity of the state, you know, like California's. Pennsylvania is a very big and diverse state, not as big as your state. And I'm thinking, well, okay, then let me go look and see what states have done you know, the two states that have done it in recent history, and there's no evidence that it increases turnout. So this is all, I think you're right. I mean, I think this is basically for Republicans to pick up a few electoral votes, but what they didn't think about was it may put their competitive congressional districts on the line, you know what I mean, meaning that it could cause them to be more competitive and maybe help the Democrats. The members of the congressional delegation in my state from those competitive CDs are apoplectic over it. I mean, they're trying not to express that as openly as I am, but they are deeply concerned about this plan for what it might do in those congressional races coming up next year.
Yeah, but of course, at the end of the day, the Republicans would much prefer to pick up the White House and they can afford to lose one or two seats.
You're absolutely right about that, but if you're a member of Congress, it doesn't make you very happy.
No, you're not a happy camper. I thank you for joining us here, Dr. Terry Madonna. Again, Professor of Public Affairs and Director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at the Franklin Marshall College. So what did we learn today on Background Briefing? Well, we began with the country's leading expert on tax and tax policy, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston. He we were analyzing, of course, the president's announcement, plans to tax millionaires and his threat to veto any Republican deficit reduction plan that doesn't include raising revenues. It does certainly feel like the president is laying down some markers, acting like a president, and a little too late in the game for a lot of people, obviously. But, David K. Johnston welcomed it and thought it really was, it could be a game changer. He felt that the president really was going to box them in, to a pretty difficult choice, to reject stuff that, their base, the business community, would really like, deferring taxes and getting reward tax benefits for hiring people. The Republicans have laid down this marker that, we've got to protect millionaires and billionaires, and there's not going to be any revenue increases. So the battle is on. He also said that the billionaires, the Koch brothers and company, clearly, no surprise that they're enormously benefited from the Supreme Court ruling. They can spend unlimited money. But he doesn't believe they're cynical. He believes they actually believe that if the oligarchs run this country, somehow it will be better for all of us. When the evidence is so manifest that as you concentrate more and more wealth in the hands of the fewer and fewer people, there's less and less to go around for the rest of us. I mean, the president himself talked about this is not about class warfare. This is about math. But class warfare, of course, comes up all the time. It is the refrain. David K. Johnston did mention that the president, the person who the bill's named after, the billionaire Warren Buffett, said, yeah, sure, there's class warfare and the rich won. But it still seems to be an argument that that seems to have some traction. At least presumably that's why they use it all the time. But I guess the takeaway from that was that maybe this is a turning point, and that the president may well be able to shame the Republicans into cooperating. I would certainly hold my breath on that prediction. Then we talked about the election rules that have been changed in various of these important states that have been taken over in 2010 by Republicans, where they control the legislatures and the governorships. Key states like Ohio, Wisconsin, Florida, state of Ohio played a huge role in 2004. And we talked with Daniel Takagi, who's a professor of law at Ohio State University, where he's a specialist in election law. He walked us through all of the restrictions that have been passed very quickly without any debate in the sort of dead of night by these Republican legislatures. They're also doing an enormous amount of redistricting in Ohio. They're combining Marcy Kaptur's seat with Dennis Kucinich's seat in this gerrymandering that'll put Kucinich out of business. Just to give you an idea of the math of gerrymandering, the state's always been evenly votes 50% Democrat, 50% Republican. That's why it's a swing state. But under the new gerrymandering, the Republicans will control 12 out of the 16 districts. So they go from, even though you have a 50-50 Republican-Democrat vote, you've got a 75-25 split in favor of the Republicans in terms of representation. So there is the, in stark detail, stark relief, if you will, the mathematics of gerrymandering. But this is happening in many other states, as he pointed out. And to some extent, it's because the American people have no idea how voting, you know, we learned in 2000 that it was kind of third world and a banana republic down in there in Florida. But, you know, the irony is that in many third world countries right next door in Mexico, voting is incredibly easy and secure and efficient. And it's right next door in Canada, tremendous turnout because registration is not an issue in any other country. So it goes back to the founding fathers who are all about restricting the vote. I guess that's the sort of political DNA that we're talking about here. And then we continued the discussion further on voting restrictions by Republican legislatures elected in 2010, planning, seeing what they could do to rig the votes in 2012. We spoke with Dr. Terry Madonna in Pennsylvania. He's a leading pollster in Pennsylvania who directs the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. The Republican legislature are planning on changing the Electoral College rules there to permanently favor the Republicans, at least in the short term, at least, in the 2012 presidential election. Previously, in 2008, Obama took the whole state. It's a winner-take-all system. He took all 21 seats. Now the Republicans have gerrymandered it down to 20 seats. But under these new rules, they would, instead of the Democrat winning all, the Republicans are likely to pick up 12 out of 20, which would leave the Democrats with 8. So Obama's total in the Electoral College is minus 12, just by changing the rules. So you can see why they're doing it. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.